Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, it's News Desk with me, John Dennis, on Friday, October the 26th. Today, a moment of truth, says the United Nations, but not all Darfur's rebel groups will attend talks aimed at ending the bloodshed in Western Sudan.
I am not talking about ceasefire. We already committed to ceasefire. I am talking to stop killing of my people.
Also today, the US has announced the toughest sanctions against Iran since the 1979 revolution. And the UK government's chief investigator into waste and profligacy has resigned 2 weeks after details of his own lavish expenses are published. Over the last 4.5 years in Western Sudan, 450,000 people have died as a result of violence and disease, according to the UN. Well, tomorrow in Libya, new talks aimed at ending the violence in Darfur get underway. The United Nations wants to bring all the groups who rejected last year's deal into the peace process. But speaking to me from Khartoum, The Guardian's Jonathan Steele told me what had happened since last year, when only one rebel group signed a peace deal.
Well, the situation in Darfur has got dramatically worse, at least from the political point of view, since last year. Because, as you say, in the 2006 peace talks, there were three main rebel groups that took part, and then at the last minute, two of them decided not to sign. Since then, the movements have all fractured and broken into different clans and tribes. This has made the whole thing much more difficult.
A UN envoy has called these talks a moment of truth. What will happen if they fail to produce a peace deal?
Well, I think it will be a disaster, because this is the best chance that there has been for about 18 months. These two rebel groups that refused to sign the last peace deal have made certain demands. Mainly, they want more compensation for people who lost their homes because of the attacks in the first 3 years of the war. The government has said that they're willing to consider that, so that it's not as though the government is being intransigent and therefore it's no longer pointless, any point in talking to them. It's just that the rebels themselves have become intransigent and, as I say, broken into all these different groups, so that there's less and less control by the political leadership over the people with guns. When you have IDP camps, displaced people's camps, in existence for about 4 years, tensions grow. You have a whole generation of young men who've grown up in camps, who've seen their fathers no longer farming their fields, who've seen their mothers now reduced to being beggars, basically, waiting for international handouts. It's a very, very demoralizing situation. And so people get more radical, they get more angry, and there are more and more guns around. And so the whole issue could degenerate into something like Somalia if action isn't taken.
There are a joint peacekeeping force between the United Nations and the African Union. Is there any cause for optimism this weekend?
Well, there is now this new force, which will be deployed from January. It's still deploying at the moment, and there are some problems there by getting the extra troops, getting helicopters, getting logistics into place. But frankly, in a country which is so huge, always described as the size of France, no peacekeeping force can really solve the problem, so that even if it now doubles in size to about 26,000, which it will be at its full complement by the end of 2008, that's still really almost a drop in the ocean. The answer has to be political. It can't be done by international peacekeepers. And so it's really up to the Darfur politicians themselves to take a deep breath and come together and try and find a solution. And that's why it's so important that everybody does turn up in Libya. And I suppose the hope of the mediators is that even if these rejectionists don't show up at the first day or week of the talks, the kind of moral pressure on them may mount, and that they will come at a later stage.
Jonathan Steele in Khartoum. Well, not all the rebel leaders are attending the talks. Abdul Wahid al-Nur, the leader of the Sudan Liberation Movement, has resisted pressure to attend from British, French and Dutch diplomats. In Paris, he told our diplomatic editor Julian Borgia that he wants the international peacekeeping force in place before talks start.
I will not accept pressure. I am the man who needs peace more than anybody else. But the process which is going on is not a real, it's not a peace. It is a prolonging of the suffering of our people and complicating the problem of Darfur and Sudan as general. And this real peace will never come by this way.
Some would say by putting all these conditions
on the peace talks. You want the outcome first before you negotiate.
People talk about ceasefire. I am not talking about ceasefire. We already committed to ceasefire. I am talking to stop killing of my people. Is it precondition?
They talk about in the first few days in Sirte that they will produce a ceasefire. They will declare a ceasefire.
Who said this?
The organizers, the UNAU, they're hoping to get a ceasefire together.
Please, we don't need new addition of agreements. We need implementation of agreements. Leadership will not be created in Libya or with the international community. Leadership is the recognition of the people in the ground. And that is only SLM and me, the chairman of SLM.
What do you think about what Mark Malik Brown, our minister, said when he said that if you don't go by not going, you risk losing your credibility, losing your leadership?
In fact, my credibility will not be created by British. And my credibility my leadership will not be created by the minister who said it. My leadership will be recognized with my people. Wherever I am talking with my people, for my people, right, I will be a leader of my people, and nobody in the world will be able to stop this leadership. I am not a criminal. I am not a sabotage of peace. I am real sake of real peace, not title peace. And that will not be in Libya and will not be in this process. Khartoum is not going to recognize 13 Security Council resolution. If this is a good guys, for me, goodbye international community.
Abdul Wahid El Nour, the leader of the Sudanese Liberation Movement, speaking to The Guardian's diplomatic editor, Julian Borgia. Now, Julian's with me now. Julian, with the absence of rebel leaders such as Abdul Wahid, are these talks doomed to failure?
Well, the quick answer is probably yes. Without major figures like Abdul Wahid there, and he has wide support in the refugee camps, it's hard to imagine anything conclusive coming out of it. The thin hope that the mediators have is that somehow the process that goes on in Libya involving civil society leaders, refugee leaders, will begin to gather momentum, and people like Abdul Wahid will begin to feel, I'm being left out of something here if I don't go. And then it will have a snowballing effect. So far, Abdul Wahid and people like him are holding firm. But the mediators are saying, what else can we do? There is nothing else we can do other than to try and start something small, start talking about the small things, and hopefully this process will gather momentum.
Now, another story that's dominating the international headlines today are the new sanctions from Washington on Iran. Julian, what's the US announced?
Well, they're putting a new wave of sanctions on the Iran's Revolutionary Guard for exporting weapons of mass destruction, they say, is for exporting ballistic missiles. And they're calling the Quds unit in the Revolutionary Guard a terrorist organization, a supporter of terrorism, and a bunch of Iranian banks as supporters of terrorism. Now, this is a new thing. It's the first time a state-sponsored or a state organ has been labeled a terrorist organization, and it will give the U.S. The right to go after, or in Washington's eyes at least, the right to go after this unit to try and pin down whoever's involved with it, whoever's financing it, and treat them as supporters of terrorism.
This is the harshest measures that the U.S. has imposed on Iran since 1979. How has Iran responded to this?
With defiance, as usual. Iran's in a very defiant mood. The oil price is up. It's feeling very confident. It's feeling particularly that the U.S. is bogged down in Iraq and can't do much about Iran. So Iran is certainly acting and probably is relatively unworried. They even seem to be unworried about the possibility of a military strike.
Julian Borgia. Elsewhere on Guardian Unlimited today, the fight back starts here for troubled Britney Spears. Her new album Blackout receives a 4-star thumbs up from our chief music critic Alexis Petridis, and that's at guardian.co.uk/music. At guardian.co.uk/science, James Randerson reports that the scientist John Bourne, an expert on TB and cattle, has condemned the government's advice to cull badgers. He says it's hastily written, superficial and selective. And at guardian.co.uk/books, Michael White reports that Tony Blair, remember him, has finally signed a deal to write the memoirs of his life in Downing Street. A source close to Tony Blair says that the book will be frank but not disloyal to Gordon Brown. Sir John Bourne is to step down as the head of the National Audit Office. Gordon Brown led the tributes to his achievements during a 20-year stint as the government's chief spending watchdog. Our political correspondent, Tanya Branigan, says that Sir John's resignation was not connected to the revelations a couple of weeks ago that he himself had cost the taxpayer hundreds of thousands of pounds in expenses.
Yes, well, there's certainly quite a lot he's been spending money on. He spent £365,000 on foreign visits in 3 years, and in several cases he was travelling with his wife, which he said he needed to do because there were sort of social events, but also travelling first class, so he was certainly racking up the bills there. But he also ran up about £27,000 in expenses, and that was spent sort of entertaining people at places like the Ritz and the Savoy and the Dorchester, which lesser mortals like ourselves set foot in rather rarely.
How embarrassing was this revelation that Sir John Bourne was racking up these expenses to the National Audit Office?
I think it's deeply embarrassing because the National Audit Office, of course, is the watchdog that oversees all government spending, and that means it's looking at waste and it's looking at extravagance and telling people, officials and ministers and so forth, where they should be spending their money better. Now, if he's spending this sort of cash in this sort of way, that really does raise sort of some questions about his own judgment. And the other issue which really sort of worried MPs perhaps more was the fact that he was accepting hospitality from companies, including EDS, for example, which is a big computer firm and is a government contractor and therefore the kind of company he would oversee, and BAE Systems, again, quite a controversial company in some ways. And he had in fact refused to release an NAO document dealing with one of BAE's most controversial defence orders, the Al Yamamar deal with Saudi Arabia. And really, people who've known him said, well, you know, we don't think he's necessarily a conflict of interest, but it's the sort of the Caesar's wife factor. His job is so important that he has to avoid even any appearance of a conflict of interest.
We should say that he was actually cleared of any wrongdoing, though, wasn't he, by the Public Accounts Commission, which oversees the National Audit Office?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Public Accounts Commission looked at this and said he's abided by the rules, you know, he hasn't broken the rules. But they then went on to say, rather crucially, that perhaps there was a problem with the rules, that the rules should be tightened up. Sir John sort of subsequently agreed himself that he wouldn't travel first class or travel with his wife without sort of prior approval. So he obviously recognised that there sort of had been a problem. And what was really important yesterday was that Jack Straw told the Commons that he was going to make parliamentary time because the Public Accounts Commission was looking into the whole issue of how the NAO is governed, and that will look obviously at the role of the Auditor General and what sort of accountability he has. One thing that is quite important to say is that the NAO are saying, you know, this isn't connected to his expenses, that he's just decided to go. There's a sort of very technical point which essentially means that Sir John is also on the chair of another body which is going to begin looking at Auditors General. And he says, well, these two jobs are incompatible, essentially, that he'd end up sort of inspecting himself. I have to say, other people suspect that the expenses may have been certainly a factor in his mind, because he's gone from being the head of this rather powerful body, which is the sort of the supreme spending watchdog, to simply continuing with his role as chair of the Professional Oversight Board of the Financial Reporting Council, which is a bit more obscure, let's be honest.
Tanya Branigan. Coming up in Newsdesk, the leader of the Scottish Nationalists, Alex Salmond, opens his first party conference since becoming First Minister at Holyrood. We talk to him. In Gaza, Hamas leaders are coming under increasing pressure to return to violence, Clancy Chassé reports. And in football, as Martin Yol leaves Tottenham Hotspur, Spurs fans lament what they say has been a PR disaster. On Sunday, Argentinians vote for a new president. It's expected to be Cristina Kirchner, according to The Guardian's Latin America correspondent Rory Carroll.
It's the climax of Cristina Kirchner's campaign. The election is still 3 days away, but her supporters are convinced she's won. There's no suspense left in this election. They feel that her victory is inevitable, so this is just a party.
Rory Carroll's in Buenos Aires. I asked him if the result was in any doubt.
There is a consensus that Cristina Kirchner is going to romp home, and almost certainly in the first round. They say that she's polling more than 40% among voters, and that in a very crowded field of more than a dozen candidates, this should be enough for her to clinch victory in the first round.
What was the appeal to voters of Cristina Kirchner?
There's several things. The key thing is that she's deemed the continuity candidate, that the Argentinians have had a government that they credit with digging them out of the economic collapse from 2002. They feel that the last couple of years the economy has picked up, and that those traumatic times from that economic collapse are now over, thanks to the incumbent president, Néstor Kirchner, and they feel that Cristina is going to continue those policies, and so that's the main appeal. But in addition to that, she's very much her own, a strong woman. She's a very attractive woman, and they feel that certainly in the poor areas, in the slums outside Buenos Aires, they feel that she's going to continue this trend of Peronism, which is very much a populist policy of giving subsidized food to the poor people. And so people feel that she's basically on the side of the poor.
And there's a chance that Néstor Kirchner might return to power after Cristina's term in office.
Yes, there's speculation that they're going to do like a relay race, and that he's passing the baton to her now. She'll do a four-year term, and when she's finished that, she'll pass the baton back to him, and so they can do almost put in a dynasty into Argentina. Now, the couple have denied that. They're saying that Néstor Kirchner is just going to retire, but there's a lot of... Well, I guess we're going to find out in 4 years' time.
The power of Cristina Kirchner and her husband, it does have echoes of Eva Perón, doesn't it?
Certainly, and to an extent, Cristina has played that up. She's adopted the same pose as Eva, as Evita, for example, clasping her hands to her bosom. And also, some of her rallies, they've actually played grainy black and white footage of Evita Perón addressing masses from her balcony. So they certainly played the Evita card. But having said that, Cristina has been at pains to say that she is her own woman, and that she is also a professional politician. She's a lawyer, and that she's very much a different personality to Evita, who was, of course, an actress and an icon, as opposed to very much to the professional operator. And if anything, Cristina would prefer some comparisons to Hillary Clinton.
What do opposition supporters say about the Kirchner's government?
They say that they've been lucky, that the reason the economy has turned around is that commodity prices for a lot of agricultural products, which Argentina exports, have surged in the last few years, and that basically any government that would have been in power over the last few years would have benefited from this. And so that basically they've done that. And also that the government has actually made a hash of things, that although the economy has got better, there's actually a crisis brewing. Inflation is now in double digits and it's climbing ever upwards. There's also an energy crisis brewing, which is going to reduce probably more electricity blackouts. So people say that actually there's a lot of serious problems, and that the shiny Argentina of today is actually not that shiny at all, and that the truth will come out over the next coming months.
Rory Carroll in Buenos Aires. Today in Aviemore, the Scottish Nationalists begin their first annual conference as a party of government. The SNP's victory in the Scottish parliamentary elections in May stunned the Labour Party in Scotland. The party's leader, the Scottish First Minister Alex Salmond, spoke to The Guardian's Scotland correspondent Severin Carrell, who asked him whether he can deliver the SNP's long-cherished ambition, independence for Scotland.
Well, we'll deliver independence when the people of Scotland vote for it, but I'm hoping to be in a position to introduce a bill to get it through this Parliament in 2010. You know, I've accepted, as you quoted to me, that the parliamentary arithmetic currently means that's not totally under my control, but I'm not. I mean, what is under my control is to introduce the legislation. I can do that bit. What the Parliament does with it is up to the Parliament. But then, let's say, for example, that the Parliament were to throw out this initiative, remembering, of course, that whatever people's views on independence are, the idea of having a referendum on independence is fundamentally popular. you know, it's an 80% answer. Then, of course, if that happened, then presumably that issue would be something that people would want to bear in mind when the next came to cast their votes and the next parliament, which then hopefully would be in a position to take forward these matters. So I want to concentrate on two things. One, the things I'm in control of, and that is running an effective administration which is doing the business for the people of Scotland. Most people, beyond our political opponents, say that that's what we're doing at the present moment. Secondly, to keep our eyes on the prize. I mean, I care about making Scotland more competitive, more prosperous. I care about not having a next generation of nuclear missiles in Scotland. I care about Scotland's vital interests, like fishing and farming and oil and manufacturing and the things that matter to people in Scotland. So as long as we do a combination of running an effective government and keep our eyes on the vision of a better future, then I think we'll strengthen our cause and we'll strengthen the independence cause.
Do you think that Gordon Brown is a Prime Minister that's going to be a better Prime Minister for Scotland than his predecessor, Tony Blair?
Well, I certainly hope to have a better relationship with this Prime Minister than I did with his predecessor.
Hasn't been terribly good so far, though, has it, with the budget, for instance?
The relationship started very well because we're cooperating on the terrorist threat and also cooperating in the response to foot and mouth. But, you know, I think we'll work our way through that. But, you know, one thing is clear. I mean, I want to have as good a relationship as I possibly can with UK government ministers. But I have to take my instructions from the Scottish people. What's in the interest of Scotland is going to dictate my approach.
But the Scottish people...
And I am not in any of the things that we're disagreeing with the UK about at the present moment. None of these things I've manufactured. These are all things which are substantive differences between the interests of Scotland and the interests of the United Kingdom government as interpreted by the current group of government ministers. I'd love to have a great relationship with Gordon Brown. I think it'd be far better for us both if he let the SNP government go on with running Scotland and he go on with running the UK government and obviously preparing for the next UK election.
Alex Salmond, and there's more on him, written by Severin Carell in Saturday's Guardian. In today's papers, the YouGov poll for The Telegraph puts support for the Tories at the highest it's been for 15 years. Cheer for Cameron, it says. The Conservatives have a 3-point lead over Labour, 41% to 38%. The Lib Dems, currently without a leader following Ming Campbell's resignation, have just 11%. The Daily Express also has a poll. 70% don't believe the McCanns is its front page. He Took Maddie is the sun splash. Its front page and that of the Mirror features a drawing of a swarthy man based on a description by Kate and Jerry McCann's friends of a man seen near their holiday apartment in Praia da Luz in Portugal. The sketch was released by the McCanns. Diana's last words, "Oh my God, oh my God," that's according to a witness giving evidence to her inquest, reported in many papers. Also in The Telegraph, from next September, the government's going to vaccinate all 12-year-old girls against a virus that causes cervical cancer. It's not all good news, though, says The Telegraph. Britain's one of the last countries in Europe to organise the vaccine, and that delay may lead to the deaths of 420 people. The Times says the survival of humanity is at risk, according to what it describes as the Earth Audit. And that's a study involving 1,400 scientists for the United Nations. In an urgent call for action, it says that the speed at which mankind is using the world's resources over the last 20 years means we're each using up a third more land to supply our demands than the globe can supply. The Independent leads with the same story. It says that the availability of water has decreased dramatically over the last 20 years, while the human population has increased by a third. It also reports that the operatic tenor Russell Watson has had an operation to remove a brain tumour after complaining of headaches during a recording session. The Daily Mirror is one of many papers reporting that two boys died crossing the M6 motorway in Cheshire. One of the boys' grandmothers is quoted as saying, "The poor little things probably went into the woods and got lost in the dark. They saw lights coming towards them, but what could they do?" The Daily Mail reports on its front page the Great Commons gravy train. MPs pick up £200,000 on average for working just 34 weeks a year. And there's more on the papers, guardian.co.uk/wrap. In his final report from Gaza for Guardian Unlimited, Clancy Chassé witnesses at first hand the pressures on the ruling Hamas faction to resume its campaign of violence against Israel.
Since Hamas has assumed power in Gaza, its militancy has dropped significantly. Besides Al-Aqsa, Islamic Jihad has become the dominant resistance group in the Gaza Strip. It insists on unity between all factions in order to fight Israel. I was given access to Islamic Jihad in northern Gaza. These men are trained to engage heavily armored Israeli troops with only small arms and rocket-propelled grenades. Many of them told me they expected to die on their missions.
They put on quite an impressive display, quite well choreographed, guerrilla procedure, and chasing them around through these orange groves.
The next day, Islamic Jihad launched a devastating rocket attack on a nearby Israeli military base, in what would later turn out to be the largest operation since rocket attacks against Israel began.
We woke up this morning to news of an Islamic Jihad strike on an Israeli military base. There's a lot of tension in Gaza this morning, as many people fear a retaliation.
Israel's retaliation had begun with an Apache helicopter strike on a carload of Islamic Jihad fighters. They were able to exit the car seconds before the rocket hit, escaping with only minor injuries. We heard a report that Islamic Jihad was to hold a makeshift press conference on one of the corners of Gaza's busiest streets.
Resistance alone is the only way to unite our people, regardless of their political affiliation. We stand together above our differences. Our jihad and our operations will continue until the oppressors pay for their oppression.
The following morning, I received a tip-off from a senior Hamas official that the leader of Hamas's authority in Gaza, former Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh, would be leading Friday prayers at a Gaza mosque.
This is an exceptional situation and has been imposed on us by outsiders. This is a flagrant interference on Palestinian affairs and an attempt to sidestep the outcome of the elections and the democratic process.
The Hamas leadership is more and more isolated. Efforts to gain international legitimacy have borne little fruit, and amid worsening conditions, Hamas faces increasing pressure from both inside and outside the movement to return to violence.
Clancy Chassé, and you can see all three of Clancy's films from Gaza at guardian.co.uk/insidegaza. Football, and the Dutchman Martin Jol has left Spurs. He was told of his sacking before he oversaw Tottenham's 2-1 defeat to Getafe in the UEFA Cup. The chairman of Tottenham Hotspur Supporters Trust, Daniel Wynne, says Jol went against the wishes of many fans.
The board obviously make the decisions, not the fans. And as much as we like to think we have an influence, it's their club, they make the decisions. You know, they brought themselves into that position. They were clearly unhappy with one or two things behind the scenes. What was unfortunate and, you know, quite poor as far as we're concerned was the fact that they lined up a successor in August and were caught in the process, and that left the manager really in an untenable situation. He was under so much pressure after every game that we didn't win, and you know, we did lose and draw far too many games this season, and you know, after every single one of those, it's basically, or how much longer have you got left, and you know, what's your future here, and all that kind of stuff. He was just under far too much pressure, and it was a situation that really wasn't of his doing, apart from the fact that results didn't go his way.
Did he still have the backing of the players?
I think up until recently, I'd have answered that yes. You know, you saw the game against Aston Villa where we came back from 4-1 down, and there was the wild scenes of celebration when we got that late equaliser to come back from that 4-1 scoreline. Up at Liverpool a couple of weeks ago, we were 30 seconds away from a famous victory up there, and you know, things seemed to be going relatively well in as much as the players were still playing as a unit. I think on Monday night that was not the case. You can look at that team, and the players should be playing far, far better. There's obviously a dip in confidence, you know, that runs right the way through the spine of the team there, and players that were on the top of their game last season just weren't performing this year.
What do you think of the way the club has handled the departure of Jol? It's been a bit of a PR disaster, really, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think, you're definitely the master of understatement there. It has been a PR disaster. It's, as I said, you know, they're entitled to, you know, set him challenges. They are entitled to set him objectives and question the way he's going around things. But do it in private. Don't play it out on the back pages under the full glare of the praying media. And you know, you guys in the media like nothing better to fill your column inches and to, you know, fill airtime on any kind of situation that may or may not arise. And boy, did a situation arise, and the media played on that, and you know, that was all down to the way the board acted.
Daniel Wynne from the Tottenham Hotspur Supporters Trust. Today's edition of News Desk was produced by Phil Maynard and Andy Duckworth. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.